What's happening, people? Welcome to this week's episode of the Football Fans Podcast, The Face Off. We are, as you know, still in a lockdown and doing all our shows on Zoom, as is everybody else. But hey ho, we can still put out some good shows nevertheless. We're going to stick a pin in our usual shows we've been doing during the lockdown of going over some iconic Premier League matches, having some fun with that. We're going to put a pin in that for 1 week because we've got a special guest with us this week. And I really want to drill down into a discussion around what's currently happening in the country with a football perspective on it, with the discussion around should football come back or shouldn't it not. But more importantly, because we've got a player this week, I'm really interested to kind of get a player's perspective on what he thinks. We've got Gabriel here, whatever, he's every week, so don't worry about him, he's fine. our special guest on the show this week is the former Reading, Watford, Crystal Palace, plenty of other clubs, and Jamaican international, Joby Mackinoff. Joby, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm very well, thank you very much. Can't complain in the current climate. Family's healthy and trying to keep it that way. So as long as that's the case, I'm good for now.
Good. I want to hear from you, Joby, and Gabriel will chip in with some kind of questions as well. But I want to hear from you as someone that's played the game and still in the game. Get your perspective on what you make of what's going on, but more importantly, from whether the players have been included enough, and we'll just get your thoughts on that. But before we get to that, I'm asking you how you are, but I kind of mean it in a true sense. I think we kind of often ask people as like a greeting, how are you, we move on. But because I think it's very easy to kind of lose sight of what's going on, it's a madness. We are in lockdown, there's a pandemic. It's very easy to kind of really not check seriously, listen to how people are. So when I say, how are you? Literally, in this current climate, how are you?
Like I said, I'm good, man. I've got, two kids, 6-year-old and a 4-year-old, two boys. So again, my primary concern at this stage, as it is in any other time, is my family's welfare. You know, my kids are at home, my parents, and I think that's why this, crisis as it is at the moment, has been such a big issue, certainly around the game, because I think too often we lose sight of what is the most important thing. And it's very easy to do it, not just in football, but in every other walk of life. And I'm hoping that from it, at least people will be able to maybe get a little bit of a better perspective of what is really important to them in their lives. And I'm hoping that at least people might be able to get that out of it, because it's very hard not to lose that balance sometimes, and maybe not spend as much time as you should do, in and around the people that you love. Mm. And I think this situation's almost forced people that might not usually be able to do that to be able to do that, So again, I'm the kind of person that tries to take or make a situation the best you can. And obviously this is a difficult time for so many people on so many levels, across the world. It's not even just restricted to our country. But I still feel, we've got to try and make the best of it. And that's certainly what I've been trying to do, on the day-to-day side of things.
You're on this every week. So, I speak to all the time to you every day. But, out of manners, how are you as well? I know you're missing football and you've been campaigning for the game to just come back regardless, but on a wide...
George had to set me up there.
Where's it? Halftime, open the gates. That's the one. How are you and how are you dealing with this lockdown? I've not properly asked you.
No, I'm good. Really seeing the importance of trying to keep kind of a routine. I don't have any children, so it's me and my missus and trying to keep each other going and, getting used to that. I mean, I think we're both used to that, not having a 7-hour break from each other normally, but now we're together all the time. I'm sure like she's at the end of her tethers, but just looking for little things. Surprisingly enough, we bonded over a PlayStation, never saw that coming. So it's just little things like that you can do to kind of keep your mind fresh. And going out for walks, but mainly keeping a routine, keeping a bit of purpose and yeah, I'm still able to work from home, so just going up with work as well. And yeah, but generally I'm good. But I appreciate you asking, even if it was only a second.
It was token, to be honest, but whatever, we've done it now, so yeah, whatever, you're good. And we've got our third guest coming in a second, so I'll let him come on in a second and I'll come to him in a minute. But Joby, let me get your initial thoughts then on what you made. Let's go back a few weeks now. What were your general thoughts of when you realized that nationally the virus was hitting us and this was becoming a big problem for us, not just a foreign story that boy over there is kind of peak, but it's all right over here. When did you first realize that this could be an issue for our country? And second of all, what were your initial thoughts on how we as footballers, or you as footballers in the football industry, should have dealt with it?
Well, going back to obviously the first initial stages of it, I was actually quite worried quite early. And again, going back to the family side of things, both my parents are over 70, so they're in the high risk from the age point of view. My mother-in-law is actually in the highest possible risk group because of previous health issues. So once we heard the implications and certainly those people that were in the most danger, we actually went into lockdown a week before the government announced it. So we took the kids out of school and have been quite serious quite early. Okay. You know, I think from a football point of view, once the games got cancelled, that was the first real, all right, this is really serious. But I've got to be honest, at the time I was a bit like, you know, it might be a couple of months, you know, then we'll all get back to it. And, you know, again, I don't think anyone really knew the extent of it at that time. And I don't think we also knew the complications that would arise, whatever scenario we're looking at moving forward, whether it is trying to finish the season or not, either way, it is just a minefield. So, listen, it's going to be difficult whatever way you look at it, but it's circumstances no one could ever have imagined. And again, we've just got to try and find a way through it, man. That's all we can do.
So forgive me, sir, I should have asked you actually what your current situation is. You're at Leighton Orient at the moment. Just talk us through currently. Are you player manager? Are you captain? What's happening there?
Bit of everything, actually, except for the management bit at the moment. I'm captain, first and foremost, player and coach. So I haven't played as much as I would have liked this year through injury, but that's the only really reason. And funny enough, I just about got myself fit, got back on the pitch for the first time in months and months and months, the week before, obviously, the shutdown. So from that point of view, it was like I was ready to kick on, you know, for the last 10 games of the season. I'm out of contract, so from a playing point of view, that's certainly, as it always is at any time, a very unsettling period, and not knowing what the future holds is not a nice place to be, full stop. You know, I have been offered a coaching role, and that is certainly something I'm, you know, very much considering and something I'm looking to get into in the future. So, again, everything's been put on the back burner, you know, from the club's point of view. They're just simply, at this moment in time, not in a position to talk about next year because there's so much to deal with this year. And I think that is obviously the same up and down the country, whatever level. So there's a lot of uncertainty around. And, you know, again, I'm fortunate. I'm 38. So, you know, in more ways I've had my career, there's lads that are around at 22, even younger, you know, in academies, you've seen them all shut down now. You know, lads that have got mortgages, they've got kids, you know, they're not contracted for next year. It's going to be a real difficult summer, you know, for everybody involved. And, you know, it's not going to be a good time to be out of contract, that's for sure.
Josh, you with us?
Yeah. Can you hear me? Yeah.
We can hear you. We can hear you. All right.
Good stuff.
And we'll come to you in a second. Do you have a question, G? Because I can go forever. Is anyone you want to ask, say?
Yeah. How much communication, as a senior player at your club, how much communication are you getting from the club regularly about what might happen about the season, about how things, I mean, is it players are kept in the dark, or, you know, are there general updates? How are you feeling about that?
To be honest, in the initial stages, it was very frequent and, you know, obviously things are changing pretty much day to day. You know, what we were hoping to do maybe regarding training before the total shutdown. Then obviously the shutdown got announced, the lockdown, so then things changed slightly. Then we got put on furlough. So again, the dynamics of the club changed, and then you have to be super careful in terms of what information is passed to what person, because obviously we're not technically allowed to work, you know, moment in time. So from a player point of view, generally, I'm trying to keep the lads in the loop with as much information I can as the captain, and being privy to a little bit more information than probably they would be. But I've got to be honest, the last 2 or 3 weeks, there's not really been anything to report. It has been, we need to wait and see what, you know, government level is. You know, clearly nothing has really changed, certainly in our leagues. I know you've got Project Restart, and I'm sure we'll get onto that later on. But in terms of the League One, League Two, it's, again, not a lot of information at the moment. And unfortunately for the lads, it's just a bit of a patience game and a bit of a waiting game at the moment.
Go on, Jane.
Yeah, I was going to say, the other question that I guess a debate kind of we've been having amongst ourselves and groups and stuff is really, at what point do we say it's safe for football to come back? Obviously, football's not the most important thing, but it is. I guess if you said take away the care workers and schools and stuff like that, football then comes quite high on a lot of people's lists. So what I'm asking is what point do we say do footballers in general, I guess from your perspective, feel safe? I mean, is it when the government reaches their measures? Is it a vaccine? What would make you feel safe as a footballer to kind of say, okay, I'll be happy to kind of go back into the pitch with some safety precautions in place?
I've got to be honest, I think that is the hardest question to answer right now. And I think footballers up and down the country will have different answers to that. For me, at this moment in time, it's impossible to make it completely safe, no matter what precautions taken, you know, barring possibly going away, you know, and staying away somewhere and trying to make that environment as sterile as possible. Testing before players go in there to know whether they've got it or not. But then you're still going to have potential issues of people coming from an outside environment into that environment. And for me, that would only even be possible. And I still think there'd be lots of reservations at Premier League level. I don't think that's going to be able to be carried out, certainly not in League Two and League One from a financial point of view and logistically. So then it comes back to the danger. We are a contact sport. Now, there's lots of other places of work that you could go into with the right safeguarding measures and precautions and not have to come into direct contact with people. Football, for any measure you try and do, it's impossible. You're running around, you know, you're sweating, you know, you're obviously, fluids are coming out of your mouth, you know, you're coming into contact with people constantly, and that's training and games. So I just feel this moment in time, it is not safe. It is just not going to be possible to guarantee that safety. Now, whether, again, that's a question for players to say or answer, we can get it to this point, but we cannot guarantee your 100% safety, do you accept that? I think that's the best you're going to get to, and then it's going to be up to the players to decide whether that is acceptable, because I just don't feel you can make it 100% safe. And again, you know, people talk about testing every couple of days. You only have to look at what's happening in Germany, you know, to see how quickly that can get derailed. And again, we're then going into an environment, we might not have it on that day, we might come into contact with someone who's got it. We don't know we've got it for that day or two. Come home, come into contact with our wives, our children, our mothers, you know, and pass it on. And it's a big, big risk. You know, I've got a mate of mine, he's a fireman. He has got COVID, he got symptoms, and obviously frontline staff, so he got tested. So he's in a watch of 12, 6 of them got it. There was another watch that another guy worked on. They use the same fire station, obviously. He had no symptoms whatsoever, none. But because there was an outbreak in the fire station, he obviously got tested, and he's positive. And I think that is the big fear for me, the fact that people can carry this virus without actually having symptoms or very mild symptoms and pass it on without even knowing. And I think for me personally and other lads that I know, that's probably, you know, the biggest fear. There's so much uncertainty around it and a lack of information around the actual virus. So how can we be sure? You know, it's difficult.
Joby, do you get a sense that the players that you're in and around at Leyton Orient and just generally really understand the power they hold in where football goes and what happens or doesn't happen? Because we saw Sergio Aguero speak out last week saying, boy, I'm not really sure that I'm comfortable coming back right about now. I'm not confident that, you know, it's safe to come back. And I think he was quoted as saying that some of either his teammates or colleagues, so other teams' players, agree with him. And my thing is, like, especially at that level where they're multimillionaires, they don't have to play football. They can afford to just wait and say, listen, until there's a vaccine or until we're sure and comfortable it's safe, we're not coming back. Do you get a sense that, you've been left out of the conversation, discussions as to when the Premier League returns or not and other leagues return or not? And secondly, do you feel that players really understand their power in what happens next?
I definitely feel more dialogue can be had between the players and some of the governing bodies. It is certainly a measure that the EFL have brought in over the last, I'd probably say, 2 weeks. There's been a committee of players' representatives, basically, that have been involved in, you know, talks about, you know, where things are and potential to restart at our level. So there is a voice now for the players, which is very, very important. I do feel they would understand the power that they hold. Ultimately, you can't play football without footballers. That's the bottom line. So if a man's getting up in the morning and he don't want to go in, and the other man don't want to go in, and the other man don't go in, then clearly there's going to be an issue. And again, you know, any workplace in any walk of life has a duty of care to its employee, and that is to offer that employee a safe place of work. Now, again, can any football club right now or the Premier League absolutely 100% guarantee the safety of every single person at that football club? I don't think they can. So there's no way that, certainly from me sitting here as a footballer, anyone at any football club can tell me I've got to go and jeopardise my own safety or my family's safety to go and play football. As much as we all want to, and I'm out there missing it as much as anyone out there, this is my life, my love, my passion, you know, and I want to be playing football tomorrow, but I know it's not possible. And we just have to be careful that we're not doing it for the wrong reasons. You know, it's sort of a hugely financial driven decision, I feel, at the moment. And I get that because, again, football is a business, but that shouldn't be placed above people's welfare. That's where I'm at with it.
Josh, what would you do? If you were a player, what would you do and how vocal would you be regarding the decision that you want to take? So would you be like, if you were of the stance of, like Joby, I'm not coming back until you can give me some kind of guarantees that it's safe, or, you know, would you fall in line?
I don't think I would fall in line. I'm not sure at this stage I'll be particularly vocal. I think right now I have my mum is high risk, so I've been having to be quite safe with that. So even just like, we don't live in the same place, but I'm basically like her, not a carer, but I'm her go-to person. So I got to do a shopping and all that kind of stuff. So I have to go around there, even though we have to have this social distancing stuff, right? So if I was playing football, if I was a footballer, my main concern would be my family. So at the end of the day, I do want to get back to playing football, but I have to consider the fact that I have a family at home, might have kids at home. Obviously, I've got my mum to look after. So I have to weigh up the risks. Like right now, I think there's too much uncertainty for me with like just knowing how this virus even works and what the protections could be. So I think right now I wouldn't be comfortable going into play. But I don't think it's a situation where anybody's forcing your hand right now. So I wouldn't necessarily be saying so. I'm sure players within their individual clubs, maybe Joby might have a bit more knowledge about this, but within their individual clubs are probably having conversations with their clubs at that level. I don't really know how it works, but for me right now, I would be of the position that I'm not going to play. And I'll just be watching like how this stuff is playing out. If it came to the point where they then said, okay, we're going to start on this date, and I wasn't comfortable with it, then I would make that known to whoever I needed to make it known to, if that makes sense. But yeah, I don't think players, as a player, I wouldn't feel that I had to play, for instance, because this isn't just about, obviously, it's my life, but then I've got to think about my family's life and people who I come into contact with outside of football as well. So that's kind of how I would do it.
I won't ask Joby this question because it's hard and it's also a bit unfair on him as someone that is at a club. But if you were a player, and as Josh just said there, there's a meeting, I think the government are meeting on Thursday, and Boris is doing this on Sunday, where there's rumours that they're going to be talking about the first phase of certain industries and workplaces that can, they can lift to some degree the lockdown. If they said Premier League football is one of those working environments that, yeah, okay, we think it's safe enough, but you didn't, how far would you push your view that you're not confident that it's safe to play football? And do you think a lot of players will eventually fall in line and be like, you know what, if they're saying we've got to come back, we've got to come back and play? Would you really push your point to the nth degree to say, I'm not coming back, it's just too soon?
Yeah, if I felt that the assurances that were given to me weren't enough to guarantee not guarantee, because I don't think guarantee is possible. And to be honest, we can't guarantee, you know, there's a lot of other things that we can't guarantee in life in terms of risk. But if I thought there was a high risk of something which could affect me or my family, then I would purely and simply say no. Mm-hmm. And yes, what's the worst a football club can do, right? Like 2 weeks' wages or terminate me. Now, again, that's me speaking from, I guess, me imagining I'm Sergio Aguero, as you gave an example. There might be a YDS player who can't afford to do that, or there could be someone at the end of their contract who can't afford to do that.
Sorry to cut you there. Isn't this probably the one and only time where as a footballer, you can take on your club and not fear being taken to court? Because is any club going to try and go to court, take the player to court and say, well, he's breaching his contract? Because the counter would be, as you said, I'm not going to, you're not giving me a safe working environment to do my job in. So until, no, you don't think?
It's a tough one, especially if 9 out of 10 players were to come back.
I can't see any court in the land telling a player, siding with a club on this one. I can't. I don't know if...
You know what? It might not be the court though, right? Because you have to consider the pressure from the squad, your teammates, like the pressure from... Like even just like getting a bad reputation as a player who doesn't fall in line or something.
All three of you
like,
just said
all that kind of stuff.
Well, all three of you just said that if you've got kids and a mother that's high risk, do you really care about a couple of teammates?
No. I'm saying personally, I wouldn't do it, right? But then G made a good point. Gable just made a good point about, like, let's say you're a YTS player and you're at the end of your contract and you really want to, like, you know, you really want to get back into football. You don't want to be known as the person who let the team down. If everybody else in the team said they were going to play and then you wasn't. I can see their situation where there can be pressure from teammates and stuff. I think personally, like, I wouldn't personally do it, but I can see a situation where people might be caught in a sticky situation where they feel like they may have to do something they don't necessarily want to.
Yeah.
And I would hope that there are protections in place for that, but I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, can I jump in, Jordan?
Go.
This is, I think, why we do need to have a discussion about it and why it's important to get everyone's views, because same as the whole financial side of things and what players should or shouldn't give, you know, what clubs should or shouldn't do, every football club is different. Every football player is different. Now, that goes from what you're earning, what your family background is, you know, what stage of the career you're at. So everyone will have a different answer. And until you have a date that you might be able to get back to it, no one's going to really know. So again, it could be that I'm the only one at my club at this moment in time that doesn't feel comfortable. And it might be that the other 22 do. So later on, as a football club might go, well, we'll ask everybody. If we've got 22 that want to and one that doesn't, we'll crack on with the 22. Might be 17, it might be 18, it might be, you know. And again, there can't be, my big issue with it is there can't be a blanket decision that covers every single person, because everyone's situation is unique to them. So again, this is my personal opinion. In my personal situation, again, there's lads at my club that live away from home, so not in contact with their family. Their family are not in the higher risk age group or have had previous issues anyway. And I know for a fact, some would be happy if he said to them, tomorrow, we're going back to training, they'd be ready to go. So again, there is differences in everyone's situation. And that is why it's very important to just have the discussion.
But isn't that why you said that it's difficult to have a blanket decision on this? But isn't that when it all comes down to it, a blanket decision is going to need to be taken. It's going to be either, no, I don't care if the four of you don't want to play, we're playing. Or the opposite, it's a case of, okay, only four want to play, we're not going to play. So either way, someone's not going to get their way. But there's got to be a left or a right here. There's got to be a blanket decision that isn't going to, you know, please everybody. But when it's all said and done, all clubs are going to have to at some point make a decision. And it's not going to go down well with everybody.
Yeah, but listen, I think we're at that point now, Jordan. I really do. I think we're moving along the timeline. You know, it's going to get more and more difficult the longer it goes to try and finish the season. And then not to have an impact on next season as well. So I agree. I think there needs to be a decision made at this moment in time in terms of what direction we're heading in. And then it's up to people to make decisions and to see whether there's enough footballers that turn around and say, right, for example, you know, May the 15th, we're all going back, or May the 23rd, how many are going to come back? And then we'll see where we all are. There's no point in making, you know, all these dates and our football's going to return on this date when you haven't actually really consulted the people that matter, which is the footballers, and to find out if there's going to be enough to actually turn up on a Saturday or a Tuesday or wherever the games are going to be and fulfil the fixtures.
That's true, that. How at your level, the Leighton-Orient, the money obviously is not on the same level as Premier League or even Championship. So, again, as captain, are you getting a sense that there's genuine concern and almost panic amongst not just players, but staff as well, that, you know, this could really, they could lose jobs, they could be in big trouble in a way that maybe if you're a Premier League player, and I suppose even if you're a tea lady or a kit man at a Premier League club, you may or may not, you know, be hit hard. But at League One and League Two, everyone is going to be hit hard on this. Are you getting a sense at your club that people are genuinely fearful?
Yeah, most definitely. Most definitely. You know, just having a chat with some of the boys. And again, as the captain and a senior player, you know, I've made it clear from discussions I've had at a higher level and being privy to conversations with, you know, people in the EFL and club owners and chairman, that there's going to be some hard, hard times coming, you know, from a financial point of view. Football is going to be hit very, very hard, you know. And again, as players, we are going to feel it. So you have to start making provisions now. You know, again, we've been very fortunate at this football club. Our owners are real good people who want to look after everybody as best they can. Again, the furlough scheme for us has enabled them to do that from a financial point of view, but that can't carry on forever. And there will be financial implications to everything that's gone on. And that might be a deferral, which at the moment we haven't had to take. But certainly once you're off the furlough scheme, it's going to be very difficult to maintain everyone's salary at the level it is now. Again, we've had initial discussions that certainly as a group of players, we don't want to see people lose their jobs, you know, particularly those who are lower paid, if they are cleaners or chefs or, you know, really important to the day-to-day running of the club. But then if someone's out of contract this summer, and they've got no potential income coming in after that, why do they then want to give up 20% of their wages now? Because they're thinking, I'm going to need that next month. It's not for any selfish reasons. It's just they physically need that money that's coming in to put food on the table or cover their mortgage. And again, it is just a completely different conversation. You know, League Two, I've seen players almost come to blows over £100 because we didn't draw a game and we would have got £100 bonus. Wow. You know, and again, you start adding them up, you know, a few draws or a few wins in a month, and it's a nice little bit of extra money, do you know what I mean, to put aside or, you know, take your kids somewhere or go out for a nice meal. And, you know, this is going to really, really, really hurt League Two players. You know, if you're in contract, you're possibly looking at a deferral or a cut. If you're trying to get a new deal, you know, that's going to be difficult. If you're trying to get a move somewhere, you might have been promised something for next season somewhere else. That might be now out the window. And if you're out of contract, then there's going to be a big, big, big problem for people this summer because there's just not going to be as many places to go next year. Fact, you know, clubs are looking at taking smaller squads, you know, which straight away is going to cut down how many players are going to have an opportunity at another club. And then obviously the financial side of situation. If a club's got 25 pros and five are out of contract, then they've got to look after the ones that are in contract. So the chance of them boys getting a new one have been reduced straight away. So it's going to be a real difficult, painful summer. And I know for a fact that, you know, lads are very much worried at this point in time.
Without naming names, because I don't want to get anyone in trouble here, but where do you sit, Joby, on the whole discussion a week or two ago regarding the pressure, subtly but slyly, from the government that Premier League footballers in particular needed to do more financially to support the country in this pandemic, in this lockdown? Are you of the mindset that if you are earning £300,000 a week, I think someone worked out that Kevin De Bruyne, as an example, takes £8 million a year, that's without tax. Are you of the mindset that, look, we have to all pull together and those with the most have to maybe chip in and help out the country in these times? Or are you on the other side of the fence that says, listen, that's my man's money, so that you can't really tell a man what to do with his money? And even though we are all going through this and even though we're all suffering, that's still his money. He shouldn't be given side eye for deciding that, I'll decide if and when and how much money I give to whatever organisations and charities.
My big issue with Hancock coming out saying that was the fact I felt footballers were singled out. And I don't see how, and I get he will say, I was asked a question, but he could easily have said footballers and bankers or, you know, whoever else you're thinking about.
Highest earners,
whoever, you know, we need help. The reason that they need help is because they've run the NHS into the ground over the last 10 years, you know, and again, there's nothing that a Premier League footballer is going to do that's going to address that the next day. You know, we're talking, we need millions, billions, billions, billions. And all of a sudden, the Premier League going, oh, there's an extra 20% of our wages. That's not going to fix the problem overnight. Of course, I feel if you're in a position to help, you should do. But that is also a personal decision. Now, as you say, tax, the Premier League pays an awful lot of money in tax, whether that's Premier League as a whole, football clubs and footballers, and they contribute. There are footballers up and down the country that they send money home. They might not be from here, but they pay tax into our tax system because that is the law. Now, they also might be doing stuff at home, you know, in countries they come from. And there's been a lot of cases highlighted recently with players that actually do that. So I do still think it is a personal decision. I think it kind of got mixed up with big clubs furloughing some of the lower paid staff, and then you've got a guy on £200,000 a week. For me, again, that doesn't sit right. So a discussion should have probably taken place to say, is there anything we can do to stop that happening? Whether these clubs should have furloughed in the first place, I don't think they should have done. Spurs, you know, I know Liverpool made the decision and turned back on it.
I actually do, Joby. So, yeah, my issue with, it's not really an issue, but the reason why I wasn't as outraged as everybody else when it was announced that certain Premier League teams were going to be furloughing their staff was that, I mean, the first thing to remember is that the government have allowed themselves, there's they're doing nothing wrong legally or technically, and his company is taking up the furlough scheme. That's the first thing. They're not doing actually anything wrong. The second point I would say is that we're in a period of uncertainty in terms of how long football is going to be on the back burner for. I mean, we'll get into it a little bit, but I think if this weekend's announcements don't go the Premier League's way or football's way, we need to have the conversation that there could be a year, 18 months, maybe longer of no football. That's a combo no one's having. I think that with that level of uncertainty, if you are a business, and let's take off our emotional hat and put on our business hat, you have to be aware of that. Now, there's also this perception that I think Premier League clubs have unlimited funds. They have unlimited money. And while they have lots of money, and some of the top six clubs have billionaire owners, I accept that, I think if you're a business, you can't keep paying and getting nothing back and not knowing when that's going to end. So if I'm Liverpool or Tottenham, the teams that did a U-turn, I'm thinking to myself, all right, we might get a bit of bad PR. It's not really cool, maybe ethically correct, but it's better that I take the furlough option and keep my staff, the tea lady, the kit man, the groundsman, those guys that don't earn a lot of money. They're getting some money from us rather than we think, you know what, we can pay for everyone in 6 months' time, we're still no football, still no income, and then you're sacking people. And that's the reason why I think it's not, I see why they did what they did. If there was a deadline or an end date in sight, i.e., all right, boom, football's back on the 1st September, the clubs would go, all right, you know what, between now and September, boy, it's going to be a little bit sticky, but we can ride it. We can ride that. It's going to be tough, but we can ride it. The fact there's no end date, I think if you're a business, you're thinking, how much longer am I paying people with no income for? So for me, it feels only business savvy, although maybe ethically incorrect, to take an advantage of a government scheme that allows you to pay for people for as long as possible in an indefinite period. So that's the reason why I personally wasn't as outraged by it, because I understood where their business is. They haven't got time for emotions. Their business is. So that's kind of why I didn't really get outraged by it personally.
Yeah, I think from my point of view, I think if you understand the furlough rule, and I know technically, legally, they didn't do anything wrong in that sense, it should, by my understanding, be for companies that genuinely cannot afford to keep paying their employees that level of salary because they have no income. So how can you then say, I've got somebody earning 25 grand a week, and again, listen, Tottenham is a massive football club. And when it's not the old school days of one kit man, one tea lady, you know, they've got hundreds and hundreds of staff that could be earning 20, 30 grand a year. So it all adds up. But how are you going to say you can't pay somebody who's earning 25 grand a year their full salary, but I can go and pay Harry Kane 200 grand a week. And I think that's where, as football as a whole, we have to be careful, because the figures are obscene. That is football, and they are justified because it's a business. But we do have to be very careful of the perception that we give off. And I think, again, how early they claim for it. Again, let's give it a month. Let's see how the land lies. Let's see if there is any future of this season or when we're going to be next year. If it is a decision 2-3 months down the line, we've tried our best for 2 or 3 months, but we can't actually see an end to this, maybe then it's something. I think there would have been a bit more understanding of the situation. I just feel that's what probably rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. But I get your take. And again, I think where we have a problem in this country, football is a game to so many, you know. It's a passion, it's something we all love, we all enjoy, but it is a very, very big business. So again, I can see their side of the argument, but it's not justified enough for me, man. Certainly not at that level.
Geez, it's feelings and emotions.
You know what? I would go with your point if it wasn't Tottenham. I don't think, or Liverpool, like, I don't think anyone in the top six should do that. You could argue that no one in the Premier League, with the funds that are in the Premier League, should do that. But I can't accept Liverpool doing that. I can't accept Tottenham doing that. It's like, it's too far for the reasons Joby mentioned before. I could accept Burnley maybe doing that because from what I'm hearing, they could have a really difficult financial situation. I could accept Leeds making that rational argument because of the finances, and even Leeds are a big club as well. But I couldn't accept it from Liverpool or Tottenham. I think that was really poor.
But my point, Josh, is that these clubs have got masses of outgoings, huge outgoings. And without seeing their sheets, we don't know what exactly. They've got massive outgoings. Yeah. Now, again, you can argue, why do you put these individuals on such big contracts? And we'll get to lessons that football can learn in just a minute. But if you're paying out, let's take City. They've got a billion. They've got Sheik owns. They're a bad example. Spurs. Yeah, you're paying Harry Kane every week, $200,000 a week. You're paying the tea lady. You're paying every single week. They're paying direct debits coming out of their accounts. They're paying, and nothing's coming back in. Even for a club like Spurs, how long is that sustainable for? And I take Joby's point that maybe they could have waited 2 or 3 months before they knew what, you know what I mean, then. But you can't keep paying and paying those kinds of salaries and getting nothing back.
Okay, but the problem I have with what you're saying, and in theory, what you're saying, there's no issue with it. But if that is your first port of call, so you didn't think, how can I reduce my expenditure? Like, can we have a word with the players since they're not even playing? And say, like, some of the top earners, do you not mind taking a little bit of a wage cut? We've got a situation here where we need to retain some staff, right? Is there something that can be done? To go straight to furlough for me was just wrong. And that's what annoyed me. And obviously as well, what's not really been publicised is that a lot of the clubs also have deferred their PAYE payments to the government as well. So they're already getting a break from the government, regardless of whether they're doing this furlough thing or not. I know it's deferral, so they're going to have to pay it back at some point. But the government's already helping them out. So I just felt it was a bit... I just feel like... Obviously, this is not just football, though, right? This is just capitalism in general. But, you know, like, with the money coming out of the public funds, it's going to have to be paid back at some point. Mm. This is what I think people, like a lot of people... forget with this whole furlough thing is that this is going to have to be paid back at some point. The government is basically taking writing blank checks and they are getting themselves into debt, which is going to be paid back at some point.
People like me are going to pay it back, and I'm not even getting furlough. I'm pissed about that. That's a whole different...
So if you can afford to, like, I the way I look at it is your business, like, has enough money floating within itself that you can do something within that, the confines of that business, to keep it running, then you should do that first. And they didn't do that. That's what annoyed me about it.
I'll take your point. Had there been murmurings amongst Leighton Orient, your teammates, Joby, about the responses from Premier League players? Have they been disappointed in, I don't know, more not being done? And I'm aware that lots of Premier League players independently do lots of stuff. You know what Rashford does. We know what Jordan Henderson does. You know what players individually do. But has there been a disappointment that they could do more? Or is there an understanding from players that you're speaking to that, well, we kind of get it. We understand why some of them are a bit like, I'll do it on my own terms.
Yeah, I'd probably say, I've got to be honest, I think we've got enough to worry about down here in what the Premier League was. How much they are or aren't paying into whatever scheme. But again, look, footballers, whatever level you're at. And, you know, I'll go back to my previous point that everybody's situation is different. You know, I'm sure that there'll be lads here wishing they were on $250,000 a week, that they could pay 30% and, you know, be okay with it, you know. So I think the way it's been handled generally has been the biggest disappointment. You know, I think we've been slow as a professional union. So the PFA, the players, you know, I don't feel probably quick enough. Again, I don't think it had to be anything specific. And I think the Premier League's response to try and almost force the players' hands at that level and say, oh, it's going to be 30% regardless, that is just a bad move. You know, there's going to be players there that are thinking, hang on a minute, I haven't even heard from anyone and I'm waking up hearing it's 30%. You know, where's my say on the matter? You know, and again, you look at deferrals, you look at cuts, they're all different at all different football clubs. So some have not even had to have a deferral or a pay cut. You know, you look at Chelsea and you get some that have voluntarily done it, some that have had cuts, some that have had deferrals, which is also a different thing. So for me, I'm glad that they ended up setting up, you know, the fund players together. And I think from that point of view, at least you feel as though the money is going where it's going to do some real good and help people that really need it at the end of the day.
Do you feel the Premier League doesn't have a responsibility for lower leagues?
Listen, I do. But I think their answer right now is we've got enough on our plate ourselves, like everybody. But I do feel they have an obligation, certainly, to look out for clubs. At the end of the day, you know, the Premier League's a fantastic organisation. It's the football that everyone wants to watch. But a lot of that, you know, is a result of everything that goes on down the pyramid, you know. And, you know, a lot of the clubs in the Premier League have spent time out the Premier League. So, again, you know, I think for me, with the kind of money that we are talking about, I mean, the TV rights is just incredible when, you talk about the kind of figures that, you know, are mentioned when it comes to that. So, you know, there's clubs that are scratching around in League 1, 2. You know, they're getting 1,000 fans, 2,000 fans, like, you know, and for the money that's generated at the top, I do feel they have a responsibility to try and help out the smaller clubs and the clubs that try and run themselves in the right manner. And I think that's probably the biggest thing that's come out of all of this. It just shows how badly run even some of the biggest clubs are with the finances that are involved, that they can't wait a month before they have to say, boy, like, we need to go and furlough tomorrow. You know, and that for me is a scary thing when you look at the kind of figures that get banded around at that level, that, you know, clubs are literally that close, you know, a month or 2 months without any income of going out of business.
Joby, I totally agree. On the when the Premier League announced that they were going to be pausing, suspending all games, I was at work in our newsroom and I was speaking to our economics correspondent. And he was saying to me, well, we were talking about the fact that, boy, this is going to wipe out a lot of lower league clubs. It's going to be really bad for a lot of lower. And then he said to me, yeah, but don't underestimate how, and this, I've been banging this drum for a few years now, don't underestimate how many big clubs, even Premier League clubs, they won't go under, but they're going to be in serious problems. And he didn't go into naming clubs that he thought it would affect more than others, but he was saying there'll be Premier League clubs that for sure are going to be in trouble. Because they mismanage their finances. So I think a lot of people kind of the talk often when it comes to discussing clubs going out of business and being in trouble, rightfully goes to the teams in the lower leagues, and I understand that. And there's a lot of teams that are going to be in big trouble. But I don't think people should underestimate how some of the bigger clubs as well, whether you should care or not, it's a different subject. But don't underestimate how big. Well, no, because I think that it's their own fault. You know what I mean? If you're generating that much money from TV rights and whatever, you should be safe. You should be secure. But he was saying to me, like, there'll be some Premier League teams that will be nervous, really nervous, and not to underestimate that. At your level again, at League One and League Two, how fearful are you for clubs like yours and the leagues themselves? Do you see 5, 10 more clubs possibly going to the wall?
Unfortunately, yes, is the short answer to that. I think even before this crisis, there were, you know, probably a handful of clubs that, again, were a month, 2 months, 3 months, you know, close to getting out of business. You look at, you know, what happened with Bury already. You know, Macclesfield have also had, you know, major issues this year in terms of paying people on time. I think Oldham have got a similar situation. And I think this is just going to put the nail in a few extra coffins, you know what I mean? It's something that, again, lower league clubs survive sometimes on those gate receipts, you know, and, you know, a club that could generate, for example, 100 grand a game, say an average League Two team, you know, that's going to go a long way to covering those expenses for the month following if you have two, three games a month at home, then you know you've got that money coming in just to keep things at bay and keep things ticking over. Mm. But you've now potentially lost that. So us, for example, have lost four games that we had left at home. So if you work around that kind of assumption, you know, you're talking £400,000-£500,000, which again would already be in the budget to cover whatever expenses need covering for the next 2-3 months. Mm. But that's now potentially gone completely. Well, it's definitely gone because we ain't going to play. If we do play, there ain't going to be any crowds. And now they're saying this is going to extend into next year. So, you know, there's going to be clubs that are really struggling. What I would really like to do is, or what I would like to see is a bit of help, because we're not talking, you know, ridiculous sums of money that can keep these clubs at the very least just ticking over for now. Mm-hmm. And for me, I would assume money that the Premier League or Premier League club should be able to do without, certainly in the short term, that would just help these clubs survive. And, you know, I'm hoping that with certain discussions at higher levels, that's something that, you know, may be able to happen, you know, moving forward.
I've just got one more question and then I want to move on, and the guys might have another one on this subject. But just finally, what are the lessons football can learn? When we come through this, and as you say, some clubs will come through it, some won't. What does this teach us about how we distribute money within our game? How, as I said earlier on, you can be a Premier League club and still in trouble. What for you are the lessons that we need to be learning going forward?
I think the biggest thing is, again, is how we distribute money, how we look after money as, again, the Premier League or as a football club, as a footballer, because, again, it's a big wake-up to a lot of players, and it's going to be. And I just feel that there has to be some kind of a structural change, whether it is salary caps or, you know, certain restrictions in terms of what a club makes and what they can pay, so that at least we know they've got enough to keep turning over. And obviously, they want to be competitive. I think the big issue is you get a lot of fans of football clubs that want the best players. They want to finish as high as they can in the league. And invariably, that means we've got to go and spend that extra 50 grand a week on a player, or 100 grand a week on a player, or 20 million on a transfer fee.
You get some teams spending 50 million on Torres, or 80 million on Paul Pogba, or it's blowing money on, like, you know what I mean? Those ridiculous transfer fees.
Where did that come from?
I'm just saying.
And he ain't even looking to take no pay cut, boy.
No, it's just true.
But yeah, I think
he's just been on furlough for like 18 months performance wise.
But yeah, I think certainly, you know, the general structure and how clubs are run has to be the fundamental lesson that we take out of this. And again, coming back to my club's owners, it's something they've been really trying to do and get across to other League Two and League One and Championship owners, is they have to make it more sustainable. And that has to apply to your football club, you know. And I think as fans, it might give everyone a little bit of a wake-up call and say, what would we rather? Would we rather have a club that was at least guaranteed to survive than try and risk everything of getting the promotion or winning the league or getting the Champions League and potentially going out of business? Do you know what I mean? And I think, there's a balance to be had to it.
Just briefly, guys, Josh and G, what suggestions would you put in place? Would you be in favour of a salary cap? Would you be in favour of like an independent governing body that solely looks at the finances of what's spent in the league, so that we can ensure that at the worst case, the richest teams in the country never, ever, ever are in financial trouble? What one thing would you, if you were in charge of the game in this country, what would you impose to ensure that, you know, teams are, leagues and clubs are protected?
I would say, for me, the biggest thing is the distribution of money. And I think that kind of highlights, you know, that big gap between the Premier League and everything downwards. And I think some of that money can go to the lower leagues. It doesn't all just have to sit in the Premier League. And I think I'd like to see some type of insurance or bond or something that every club puts towards, or every Premier League club puts towards, for an event like this, that clubs could be saved. Not for bad mismanagement, because if a club goes out of business for mismanagement, that's on their own head. But when something like this happens, there is no way, with the amount of money that there is in football, that there would be no plan or no provision to kind of deal with a big emergency. That's the thing that disappointed me most.
But where would that money go, G? Sorry, because a pandemic happens once in a lifetime. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So if, let's say your idea is there, and every Premier League team, every season, put in, I don't know, £2 million each. Every yeah. year, every club puts £2 million each. Over 10, 20 yeah. years, that's a big pot of money. Where's that money going?
I think that money has to sit with an authority or a body to manage money. There could be some investment in it. There could be some money taken out of it on a regular basis to go to like grassroots football or other things like that. But to have some type of insurance or surety, there's no way that, I mean, put it like this, you know, if we go and buy Onana, for instance, for 40 million whenever the window opens, that could probably save most of the lower league clubs. There's no way that there should be that type of disparity that the value of one player could save the whole infrastructure of football. And we need lower league football as much as people doubt it. I think lower league football contributes to the whole thing. It wouldn't be the same if there was just 20 Premier League clubs. So, I mean, I don't know exactly how it would be administered, but I'd want there to be some kind of fund. It wouldn't even have to be 2 million a year, because like you said, a pandemic happens once every 100 years. It could be quite something a lot lower, but just something to ensure if something like this happened again, there would be, or insurance of a company that one puts into and make sure that this kind of thing could never happen again.
Josh, one idea.
Yeah, I'm similar to G, but I have a slightly different take on it, because I had this like thought as well when the situation with Bury happened, mm-hmm. and I know it goes into a little bit of football ownership, and that could be a bit murky, but I feel like there does need to be, where's the question? Like, here's a thought, just a statement. Where would we be now if there wasn't FFP? I mean, financial fair play, right? And I feel like they need to look at that and make that a bit more stringent. Maybe they need to look at... I don't necessarily think there needs to be a salary cap, because I think it's just a business and that's just the nature of the business. But I do think they need to look at, like, the ratio... Obviously, this is what financial player pay does, but look at the ratio between how much you're bringing in versus how much you're spending on player wages, right? And then also... I think a good idea is to have capital reserves. So basically exactly the same as what G's saying. So capital reserves for the structure of football as a whole. So I know a pandemic happens every 100 years, but I don't necessarily believe that any club should go out of business and the club just cease to exist. I don't see that as being something that should be acceptable within football. Personally, that's just my opinion. So I would say something like that sort of fund. And I get your point that if the owner runs a club into the ground, for me, the owner should just be taken, the club should be taken away from that owner. And that's the penalty of mismanaging a football club. Should the people that mismanage that football club should be penalised, not the football club, not the players, not the fans. So that's the way I look at it. Like, football as a whole needs to look at its finances and look at how it handles crises, and a crisis could be a pandemic, a crisis could be a Bury situation, and there is enough money within the ecosystem to handle both situations. That's my opinion.
Unpopular opinion, and just again, brief answers. Joby, answer if you want, but just first of all to G and to Josh, do we have too many leagues and teams?
I don't think so. No, I've never really thought, like, I think. At the end of the day, you get players coming to the... I mainly watch Premier League football, but you get players coming into Premier League that come from different levels. Like Dele Alli came from AK Dons. You know, yeah, we got...
Do you need five?
Pardon?
Do you need five?
Yeah, because I feel like it helps with football development. You've, like, at the end of the day, and there's a, like, as much as I watch a lot of Premier League football, there are lots of fans who watch teams playing in League One, League Two, League Three, playing in the conference. Like, I've got friends who play, like, at Dulwich Hamlet and stuff like that. So, like, all levels of football, it's there because there is a demand and need for it, right? So, if there wasn't, if the Vanarama League or whatever league it's called shouldn't exist, it wouldn't. That's how I look at it. Because if people wouldn't turn up for the games, players wouldn't want to play in the league. So it exists because there's a demand and there's a need for it. And I think all of that kind of feeds into football development. I mean, where are you going to send your kids on loan if, like, you want to send a Premier League club wants to send their players on loan to a lower division, like, so they can get game time. Like, all of that stuff needs to exist within the structure. That's how I see it.
Do you need, I suppose what I should have said was, do we need 5 professional leagues? I'm not saying the teams. I'm saying, because in Germany, Italy, other countries, they don't have 5 professional leagues. So I'm just wondering if that could be part of the, do you know what I mean? I don't know. Just an idea.
No. Let's keep all the leagues, Jordan. The
question as well is that the money to run those leagues is not a lot of money. So even if you're trying to think about, like, you're trying to do it as a cost-cutting exercise, it doesn't really make any sense because you're not really cutting that much cost.
There are players I've heard of that are below League Two that are on quite big salaries. I'm like, really? Do you need to be on that salary?
If, like, what's the percentage of, like, running League Two versus the Premier League? Like, it's minuscule. Come on, let's be serious.
Joby's nodding there. You agree?
That's what makes football in this country so unique, so revered around the world. You know, our pyramid system, you know, for someone who's experienced every tier of it, is what makes it special, man. I think we have a competitiveness to every single league that you don't get in any other country. And that is because the strength of not just the 4 leagues, but what I found myself playing, you know, in the conference for a couple of years. You know, what other country you're going to go to in the 4th or 5th tier of football and get not just 1, 2, 3, 4 teams that can get 5,000 fans on a match day? You know, we're in London, so we've got Arsenal, we've got Crystal Palace, we've got West Ham, we've got Chelsea, we've got all these people and big clubs around us, and yet Leyton Orient are still getting 5,000 people that turn up on a match day and I want to watch their team. And they do it because they love their football club. There's an opportunity for us to potentially go higher and go up the leagues and improve. But again, that's what gives us the edge and gives our football an edge, because that relegation and that promotion. You know, you see clubs that have gone from the Premier League within, look at Sunderland, 2-3 seasons, they're down in League One. Mm-hmm. You know, and then it's not just, oh, we're down in League One, we're going to come back up straight away. It's a struggle because of the strength and the depth that we have in this country. You know, the loan system is a fantastic point. You know, players, young players that need competitive football, and ability wise they might be able to handle it, but going out every week and doing it on a Tuesday night at, you know, Morecambe or Accrington, or it's a test, man. And, you know, without that, I believe we do a big part of what makes football in our country.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'm going to rattle through a few quick points down to our last 10 minutes, guys, and let's focus on you a bit more, Joby. First thing I wanted to ask you is, Dave Kitson, former player, launched his manifesto to take over from Gordon Taylor last week. What did you make of his manifesto, and what are the 3 main things do you think the PFA need to prioritise whoever the next guy is?
You said we've only got 10 minutes.
We can go again. We can reload again. It's not a problem.
First of all, I was quite surprised at the timing of it. I think given everything that is going on, we have certainly greater priorities at hand. I thought it was opportunistic, to say the least.
But sorry to cut you there, Joby. Is this not the perfect time? Because he or another person may feel the players need representing properly now more than ever.
But that isn't going to happen today or tomorrow or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. This guy's been in power for so long and he don't want to come away and walk away from it. So this is going to be a process, and the time for that process starting isn't now, because, again, whatever anyone thinks of Gordon Taylor, he's got stuff to do, man, and some serious stuff to do. And he's got a lot on his plate. And we as a body need him fully focused to try and do that to his best ability. Is it a situation that we need change? I believe yes. I think we need a fresh approach. I think we need fresh ideas, fresh pair of eyes looking at things. Football's changed a lot, a lot, a lot, a lot. I've been playing for 20 years and it's changed night and day in that time. And he's been there a lot longer than that. In terms of the manifesto, I read through the majority of the points. It was quite long. Don't think we needed 101 questions, to be honest.
And half of them are like, and why?
Yeah, exactly. Does things need to change? Was there things in there that certainly we need to look at and address? 100% yes. Mm-hmm. You know, given the guy who's trying to bring it to the table and his past record on issues that are very important, you know, he's certainly not the right guy for me. And I mean, listen, I'm taking away even the racism side of things and his comments around Raheem Sterling, which I think have all been spoken about. And I've had my say on it, and a lot of other players have had their say on it. You want to say you want to represent footballers. Now, you're putting posts up on your Instagram of John Obi Mikel saying it's Didier Drogba. Now, again, let's take the racism out of this argument. Let's look at it on a respect level, okay? So you know what Didier Drogba looks like. You know what Ashley Cole looks like. And you're going to put on your page as banter. And again, this is that old school kind of, oh, it's just banter. And you can't even get the guy's name right, whether it's a joke or not. I would see that as disrespect if I'm Didier Drogba. And yet you want to go and represent the next Didier Drogba or Ashley Cole or whoever else, you know? And I just felt like it just, for me, nah, he's not the right guy, man. Again, back to the point, clearly there are things that need to be addressed. I think the way that the PFA is funded needs to be looked at. I think we have an over-reliance on the Premier League, and that can in turn cause some conflicts, I would say, when the players' interests need to be the primary concern. You've got a body who's practically bankrolling you. Are you really going to go and fall out with them? You know, and risk potentially losing that. You know, I think there's a lot of other issues. I think financial welfare of players is a massive issue that I would like to see handled a lot better. Again, this is a body that represents a footballer. A lot of footballers are from working class backgrounds that are not used to handling, you know, great sums of money. They're not sure what to do with it, what's the best way to ensure that they make the most of it. And that's an area that for me is completely undervalued at the moment. I think racism is clearly a massive issue for me moving forward. You know, and I just think they need to have their finger on the pulse a little bit more than they do at the moment. You know, and I do think we need some radical ideas and a different approach. Maybe not just one guy. It might be, you know, a collective of people, again, with different ideas that can just help freshen things up a little bit.
So, Joby, I wanted to also speak to you about, just briefly, there was an article out either today or maybe yesterday with the former Man United player Luke Chadwick talking about looking back on, you know, how the abuse that he got because of his features and how he looked really, really affected him and messed him up quite badly. And we often hear from players like present and past talk about general abuse they get and how it really messes with their mental health. And me, G and Josh have all been to games, so we've probably seen firsthand the kind of abuse that fellow fans can really give. And I don't think non-football fans really understand how nasty and vicious and cruel some of the stuff can be. Have you ever received a level of abuse to the point where it's either A, really kind of messed with your mental health, but secondly, have you ever considered even leaving the game because it was that bad?
I've never considered leaving the game, fortunately enough. I've only recently, probably the last year or so, been on Twitter You know, my Instagram prior to that was private. And that was for a reason, because, you know, it's very easy to get into a situation, whatever the type of abuse it is, whether it is, you know, physical in terms of what he, you know, Luke Chadwick, I actually played with him briefly at West Ham for a little bit. And again, to hear now the impact it had on him at the time, and he's the kind of guy who would put a brave face on it. You know, there'd even be probably a bit of banter flying around the actual dressing room, you know, as is normal or was normal, because again, you just had to get on with it. You know, back in the day, it wasn't a thing of like, oh, this is messing up my, you know, my mental well-being, because that just wasn't a thing, you know, 15, 20 years ago, certainly not in football. So, you know, I've been fortunate that I suppose I've made a conscious decision to try and keep myself separated, because I think that is important, particularly when you are playing, because people are going to have opinions. And it just seems easy these days for people to give abuse. You know, it's kind of like the done thing now, sometimes without even a second thought, really. So, again, from a personal point of view, you know, I've had it. I remember one game when I was at Crystal Palace, I think it was a playoff semi-final. My parents were there, my wife, and there was a fan. It was actually a Palace fan. I remember coming off the pitch and we'd lost, and obviously I was gutted. And, you know, it was the same old sort of, you know, you haven't tried hard enough, and you haven't. And again, it's different levels to all of it, but at that particular time, you know, especially the fact that he was sitting near my parents and subjecting me to this abuse, that was the one time in my career that I really nearly, I wanted to climb into the stands, and I went over to the hoardings at the side of the pitch, and I was ready, man. I was ready to get in that, you know, and they were literally having to calm me down and, you know, tell me to chill out a little bit. And again, that was one incident, you know, where I just kind of lost control a little bit. And it's very easy to do that. You know, we're all human and we all get affected by things, you know, despite the fact that footballers are earning X amount of money or they're playing in front of, you know, 70,000 people, that we are humans, you know, and we do get affected. So, yeah, I was quite saddened to read about that, actually. And, you know, it's a shame, you know, that he's had to live with that for this whole time. You know?
I'm going to give you three questions in one here. First of all, what made you change your embracing of social media? So to go from private to public. Second of all, one of our regulars, Akin, made an interesting point about a year ago on a pod about, he'll correct me if I'm wrong here, but he was saying when we discussed this subject, he thinks it should be mandatory that every club has a psychologist at every football club. Do you agree with that? Would you make it mandatory? And third, do you think we're far off seeing a player, it's ironic that you mentioned Selhurst Park where you felt that way, seeing a player jump into the stands?
Yeah, I mean, probably from my personal point of view, the fact I'm coming to the end of my football career, you know, I'm at a point where I'm pretty comfortable with myself, you know, the level that I'm at. You know, I'm at a club that, you know, I enjoy coming to every day. And obviously, it's a bit lower down the pecking order in terms of probably how much you get highlighted and how much people are actually interested in abusing you. You know, you see it a lot more at a higher level. You know, people want to get into spats with a lot higher profile people. You know, again, for me, doing a bit of media work now, and that's certainly something I'm interested in. You know, profile is important in that line of work, and giving people a bit of access, you know, and letting people know what you're doing. So that's probably my driving decision. Again, when I was really at the top end and wanted to really, you know, 100% focus on what was important to me as a footballer, that certainly would have been a distraction. You know, I see lads even now after a game scrolling through, you know, looking for that one good comment. Oh, you were brilliant today, or, you know, well done. And they probably have to scroll through 100 negative ones to get to that one. And sometimes, you know, they can't handle it, man. And it's like, it's quite sad in a sense, because they're looking for that verification from a fan when they should really know themselves whether they've performed well or not. You know, they shouldn't really be bothered about, you know, with all due respect, you know, the fans' opinion to that extent where it's going to make them worried. You know, they've got teammates, they've got a manager, you know, again, they should be able to self-assess and know whether they've delivered, you know, a performance on the pitch or not. The second point was, what's our actual
name? Psychologist, would you make it, would you mandate it for every club, in a professional club, you have to have at least one psychologist?
I'd certainly feel, again, we've spoken about, you know, the money involved in football, and to take on a psychologist from a financial point of view is not going to be something that most clubs can't afford. Again, this could be, you know, dictated by the league, you know, that it's mandatory, as you say, and, you know, it's paid for by that club, and that has to be an employee that is at that football club, you know, on a daily basis. Again, you know, there'll be players that feel that it's a benefit, and there'll be players that don't. For me, you know, even if you have one lad that felt that that would benefit them, then it would be worth having, you know, because it's a very, very high-pressured environment. You know, there's a lot that comes with being a professional footballer, you know, and sometimes you don't want to talk to lads in the changing room or the gaffer or even, you know, your missus at home, you know, and you need to have, you know, the voice of someone else who is there doing that as a job. You know, you feel you can vent, you can, you know, put your frustrations to one side or, you know, get a different perspective. So, yeah, I certainly feel that that is something. It has changed. You know, we've got one at Leyton Orient. You know, our director of football, Martin Ling's, had his own issues, you know, from a mental health point of view. And he's very open about that and always make sure that if we need to speak to somebody, there is somebody there for us. So, again, we're lucky here. It hasn't always been the case. And it actually, again, certainly at the higher level, you know, I'd be very, very surprised if there wasn't, you know, psychologists operating at, you know, the top clubs.
And the third one was, do you think, I mean, we've seen interaction with Granit Xhaka and the Arsenal fans last season. The season before last game of the season, I think it was Paul Pogba was signing some autographs, giving his shirt to a fan, and he was right up against where fans were, and he was getting some mad abuse. Do you think, with the level of abuse now footballers are getting, you saw it with Raheem Sterling at Chelsea a couple of years ago, that big incident there. Do you think with the level of abuse that footballers are getting, that, boy, we're not far off someone just saying, you know what?
Eric Dyer, you know, before, you know.
Eric Dyer, yeah.
He was in the stands, man. And again, I think we've all got our breaking points, you know, as people first and foremost. You know, and again, I think that's often, you know, put to one side, oh, he's earning his money or he's at a professional football club. So what does that mean? Like my emotions, my feelings just get switched off because I'm now representing Spurs or Leyton Orient or whoever it is. And for the most part, I feel footballers show unbelievable amounts of restraint, you know, and I'm talking on a daily basis, whether it is not responding to a troll on Twitter or Instagram. There's an easy argument, oh, if you can't take it, don't go on there. But again, you know, we should be on there and we shouldn't have to fear being abused. And I can guarantee you that majority of top level footballers would get daily abuse online and none of them react to it for the majority of the cases. The big problem is that one time you do react, whether it is physically, you know, virtually online, you know, it's a headline, the news story. And, you know, it's difficult. I would like to think that there's enough sort of measures within football grounds to hopefully stop that happening. But we've seen in the past that you just never know. And, you know, again, it seems to be getting so bitter, some of that abuse, that you're going to get people reacting. And, you know, it's not what we want to see in stadium, that's for sure.
Do you guys have any questions? I've got two final to wrap up. Is there anything you want to ask? I can.
No, you go do
it. Yeah, just one on that. So I know you mentioned about your family being at the game and there was a bit of abuse and there was a heightened situation. Have you ever felt like in a position where you didn't want family members to come to games because of abuse?
Yeah. I would say so. I think sometimes if, you know, depending on where you go, so a lot of the times, you know, even at the biggest clubs you go to, the away fans, if you're on away team, the family will be sat with any of the fans. Yeah. So, you know, I think that a lot of the time can cause problems. You know, my family have been in their own supporters and heard abuse directed at me or other players. And some people, they sometimes obviously they don't know that it's my mum or my dad or my wife or my cousin or whoever comes to watch the game. And there's certainly been occasions where I'd just be like, you know, if we're going through a particularly bad time, for example, or, you know, I might be getting a bit of stick more so than another time. And you just say to them, sometimes it really, really worth you going, you know, because you don't want to get into that situation for them. It's not a nice thing to hear. But also from a personal point of view, it's another thing that I potentially have to worry about when I'm trying to focus on my game and, you know, win a match or whatever it is that I need to do. So it's a shame, but again, they want to come, they want to support us, you know, and some of my best moments in my career, I've been so lucky that my family's been there to share them with me. And, you know, I certainly wouldn't change that. So you kind of got to take the rough with the smooth in that one.
You have two kids, right, Joby?
Yes.
Two kids. And if any of them showed extreme talent and wanted to get into the game, would you discourage them or would you be neutral? Would you encourage them or be neutral?
Well, I've got to be honest. So my six-year-old is not interested, really. He's more cars kind of guy. And I've certainly been one of these that I was never going to push kids into this because it is a hard, hard, hard business, man. There's a lot of rejection. There's a lot of competition. You know, literally every day is you need to be the best player. You need to, you know, get the next contract. You need to, you know, it's hard, man. But my four-year-old is crazy. And this is through no, you know, me taking him out there and going, right, we're going to be footballers. And just from the minute he could walk, football, football, football. Every day I get home, daddy, let's play football. Oh, let's have a football match. There's goals in the house. There's goals out the house. Like, football is his, he loves it. And there's never been a day that I've had to say, oh, let's go and play football. He's on it. So if that continues, and again, because he's, for me, shown such a great interest and wants to play football all the time, I feel he's at a level that, you know, is unbelievable for his age. He's only four, but there's such a long road to go from here to even dreaming about playing in an academy somewhere. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be on him. I feel that I'd obviously be in a position to help guide him if it's something that he wanted to do. And that's something I didn't really have, you know, from my childhood. My dad, like, he's from Jamaica, had an idea about football, but it was never anything that was massive to him in his life. But I feel I benefited from that because there was never that pressure. You know, I see so many kids in academies now, and it's almost like the dad's dream rather than the kid's dream. Mm-hmm. And you shouldn't need that dad pushing you and make sure you go to training. I remember you used to have to go to training after school in the evening to get on a bus and a tube. And, you know, my dad couldn't drop me. He was working. Mm. But that came from inside me to want to do it. And I think that's an important thing for any budding young footballer, is having that self-drive to do it. Because when all these moments do happen later in your life, you know that you're doing it because you want to do it, not because someone made you do it.
I guess I asked that question because, I mean, with going back to the abuse thing, and also it seems to me like a lot of ex-players, the majority of ex-players that I see on TV interviewed, a lot of them aren't happy. And I think it's very easy to forget that most football players don't get paid what Paul Pogba, Kevin De Bruyne, Mesut Ozil are getting paid. Most players don't get, what was it, Josh? How many Prems has Ryan Giggs got? Paul Scott? Most players don't have those sorts of careers. They're the extreme minority that are handsomely paid and are mad successful. The majority of football players might get to a couple of finals and lose them, might get onto a contract of $5,000 a week, $10,000 a week, $20,000 a week sort of thing. So I'm just wondering, you've kind of outlined the journey to become a pro footballer, which is you've got to bust your ass and give up your life for it. And then even then, you get abused racially, you know, if you're a woman, sexually. I'm talking, is it something that you would, if your son said to you, I want to be a footballer, knowing what you know, you would actively make a pathway for him to kind of enter this industry?
Yeah, because listen, for all the, you know, not the negatives, but as you say, there's only a small percentage that get to that real elite level from a football and financial point of view. But for me, football's football. I'd be playing football like I used to on the roads when I was growing up. You know, I'd be playing Power League. If I weren't playing professional, I'd be playing Sunday League, you know. So the fact that even at a lower level, and probably when you look at League Two, you know, comparatively, you got players that are earning the same money that you could go and get being, you know, a teacher in, you know, a certain amount of experience, or, you know, have a professional walks of lives if you work hard, and then you've got a career for the rest of your life. That's the difference. Footballers get to 30, 31, 32, 33, not having made that money, and they don't necessarily have a career to fall back on after that. And again, that's the education aside. We're going back to the PFA briefly, where more needs to be done to prepare players when they do finish playing. But no, man, if he loves it, then again, you know, regardless of what you're earning, you're getting paid to do something you love, man. I've had 20 years of it professionally, and, you know, I wouldn't change that for the world. You know, I've been very, very lucky, and I'll do it for free, man. Trust me.
Sorry, that sounded mad disrespectful. Like, if he don't get to the Prem, you've had a shit career and you're miserable. And that's not quite how I meant it to mean, but I think you know what I mean anyway. Just to make sure.
But listen, it's real life, man. Again, as I said to you before, like, that's why for me, it's actually been a blessing. Like, a lot of players look at it like, oh, he played lower league, or he had to go in a conference or League Two. And I'm lucky the bulk of my career was Championship, which is a bloody good level. And, you know, financially, it's a good level. And, you know, you can do the things you want to do without earning, you know, mega, mega money. But if you handle it well, and, you know, you should be okay to get yourself sorted for the next phase, whatever that's going to be. But even lower down, man, there's people fighting over, you know, when you look at the contracts and you look at some of the incentives in there. Premier League players would probably, like, literally laugh at, you know, some of the goal bonuses down here, and, you know, what you have to do to earn an extra, you know, grand bonus at the end of the season or whatever. You know, they'd probably look at it like, what is this? But again, going back to one of your previous, that is what makes football so special in this country. You've got fans that, I support Liverpool, yeah. I would go and watch Liverpool anywhere, you know, but more times than not, it's going to be at a Premier League stadium, you know, or when I finish, maybe in Europe somewhere where it's a ledge stadium, I'm looking forward to going. These people go into Accrington away on a Tuesday night, you know, Morecambe and all these different places. And that is, for me, people talk about love of the game. I've found more love for football in the lower leagues than I saw in the higher level. It's easy to love football up there. It's easy. Yeah. You know, the teams you're playing against, the players you're coming up against, like, you know, the atmospheres, the stadiums, they're full up. Like, who doesn't love football at that level? But these people, and again, I saw it in the conference, I've got Leighton Orient fans travelling up to Barrow. You know where Barrow is? I've never heard of Barrow. No. It's far, let me tell you that, yeah?
In there.
And these people going up, they always put it on a Tuesday night. Again, they're there, they're supporting us because they love their football club. You know what I mean? As a player, as someone who loves the game, to see that is like, that's why I'm here. Not, I'm in League Two, I'm in a conference. Like, so, you know, again, there's so many different sides to it. And I'm luckily, I've seen every single side, literally, you know, of the game in this country, from youth level to all the different leagues and levels. And that's an experience that I believe has made me a much rounded or more rounded footballer or person as well.
All right, just to wrap up, a couple of quick fire ones. Best player you played against?
Got to be Messi. Can I drop that one in? Is that right?
Oh, wow. Okay, I'll extend the quick fire. Give us a brief description of what happened and how and when. What?
Yeah, man. I should have sent you that picture to put on, actually, didn't I? But I didn't want to blow the trumpet. So
no, man, if you play against Messi,
let's see, as you've asked, we've got a few minutes, we'll get into it. So obviously playing for Jamaica, which again was wicked, wicked, wicked experience for me. And, you know, especially my dad being Jamaican and so much of my family there, it was a massive honour. And one of the best periods of time I had was going away and playing for Jamaica. So we got invited actually to a Copa America. So normally it's 11 teams and they have an invitational team that goes to Mexico, obviously not South America. They all play it. And then somehow we wangled an invite to the Copa America. So we were obviously buzzing. And we drew Argentina for one of the games. So we played Uruguay, Paraguay, and then Argentina. and we did well, man, to be fair. At the time, I was sort of one of the senior players, so there's obviously a big talk about who's going to get the shirt, and obviously it's sick just playing against him anyway, alongside all the rest of them, like Di Maria and Higuain, everyone. So Rudo Fostin, who was the captain at the time, he'd arranged to get his shirt at halftime. I didn't do this. So before the game, I'm sort of standing across from the halfway line, literally like face to face. I was like, just shirt after the game. He says, yeah, cool, no problem. So halftime comes, so I'm on, like I'm over to him. Like, obviously I'm thinking, right, I need to get the shirt. So Rudy comes jogging over and he said, no, I've asked him already. Now, Rudy was my roomie. He was the skip. I was kind of, say, second in command. So I'm like, all right, cool. Obviously, that's your first dibs. So I said, second half, after the second half, shirt? He says, yeah, okay, no problem. So it's like, boy, the rest of that game, as much as obviously we're trying to win the game, I'm obviously keeping one eye on the clock, one eye on Messi. Where's this guy? It got to about 5 minutes to go and I'm like looking around. I could see him. Whistle goes, so I've gone over, little trot, little jog over. I said, oh, shirt now? He says, yeah, okay, but in the tunnel, he was gesturing, obviously, don't speak English. And so I'm like, okay, cool. So I look round, everyone else is stripping off, swapping shirts, and I'm like, listen, I ain't missing this opportunity. So I went back to him, I was like, listen, can we do the shirts now? He's like, yeah, okay. So swapped over, so I've got the shirt.
Sick. Just again, briefly on that, we all know, as watching him, why we think he's great from a viewer point of view. As someone who's been on the picture of him, what was it about him that separates him from human beings?
The biggest thing I'll say about him, and it's a pressure that a lot of people probably want but can't handle, and this is for Argentina, and this is a team that's packed with world-class players. Now, as soon as anyone else gets the ball, where's Messi? We need to give him the ball. Now, he has a job and an obligation to be the one player that's going to open up a whole defence. Now, when you think about all the teams that he's ever played against, who's the main person you're trying to stop when you play against Argentina or Barcelona? Messi. So this one guy is then somehow, over the course of his career, coming up still, overcoming these obstacles and hurdles, and creating goals is the hardest thing to do in football.
Great.
And somehow, time after time, he finds a way, and more times than not, is able to do that. I think overall, that was probably their downfall for Argentina. It's like they didn't really use all the other players to the best of their ability, because it was almost like, right, let's just give it to Messi. When he lost the ball, he did not move, and they're all just running around, get the ball back. Where is he? There you go, Leo, like, take the ball. And it's just, it was incredible to be on the pitch, obviously with him first and foremost, but almost to see that pressure that he has to operate under, you know, game after game, year after year, it's giving the ball. It's literally like back in the day, your best player, just get him on the ball and let him go and do a madness and take on five players. Like, he's still having to do that at world level, you know. It's like incredible that he's managed to do it all that time. And it's just a blessing, man, to share a picture of him, man.
And briefly, in the Prem or in England, best player you played up against?
Again, I'm a Liverpool fan, so for me, playing against Steven Gerrard, I was lucky enough, we drew him in the cup. We actually beat Liverpool when I was at Reading, and we were in the Championship we drew at home and beat them at Anfield, which was wicked. Gerrard for me, Wayne Rooney as well. Just players that have got a bit of everything, man. I like my flair, I like my you know, a bit of skill, but I do, you know, I'm English, you know, come through the system. I like a bit of grit, and, you know, for me, those players probably had a bit of everything, you know, wrapped up, and that's what made them, you know, so, so special.
Did you ever play against Paul Scholes?
No, I don't think I did. But listen, as a footballer, incredible. You know, he'd certainly be up there for me if I played on a pitch with him.
Yeah, he's all right. Favourite goal you scored?
Favourite goal I scored? Oh, good one. Probably I scored one goal for Jamaica. That was a really good goal for me. And then probably I scored a goal in the playoff semi-finals for Reading to get us to the final. So that's one that I remember quite fondly, against one of my old teams as well. So
sick. And every time we get a player to wrap up on the pod, I always conclude by asking them this question. If you were, you kind of answered it earlier on, to be fair, but if you were in charge of football and you could change one thing, anything you want, just one thing to improve or change the game, what would the one thing you would do to improve the game?
You've got to prep me for this, Jordan, man.
Come on. Only one thing to improve the game, what would you do?
Yeah, I think probably just the overall sort of governance of football and how probably the wealth is spread out. Again, that probably comes now from my experience of operating at, you know, a lower level and seeing the impact that, you know, a lack of finances can have on clubs or on players. So I just don't feel we should have such a big gulf between, you know, the Premier League and, say, League Two, for example, or even lower. I think those clubs are just as important as, you know, the bigger clubs that, you know, we all love watching.
I hear you. And what's next for you? What's happening to you? You mentioned that your contract ran out. What's the next stage? What would you like to go into this period of uncertainty next?
That's a good question. That's something I'm constantly actually analysing and thinking about even at the moment. You know, I want to play on. That's primarily what I'd like to do. At 38, it's not always what you want. So, you know, I've got to kind of wait and see what Orient's position is on that. You know, for next year, again, I've been coaching this year. It's something I've really, really enjoyed and certainly want to get into a little bit more. And then I've been doing a bit of the media stuff, which again is something I really, really enjoyed. And I kind of dipped my toe in it a little bit the back end of, not this season, gone the one before that. Had quite a steady bit of work this year. And it's certainly another area that, you know, I'd like to continue on into. Again, talking about players coming to the end of their careers, the most important thing for me is having an option or options and something to focus on. Too many, because careers generally end quite abruptly. Again, I'm lucky I've been preparing for this day for probably the last 5 years. You know, when you get to 32, 33, it's like, you're done. You know, and it's just this constant thing of, no, I'm not. I've got a few years left. I've got that even at the moment. But I know my time is coming. So it's then preparing. It might be an injury. It might be a lack of a contract offer. You know, the offer's not as what you thought it was. And then lads just fall out of the game. And all of a sudden it's like, hang on a minute, I'm only 32, 33, or 26, or 27. You know, I know lads that have fallen out of the game younger because of injuries. And, you know, it's a big void to fill without that football. So I'm just trying to get a few things in the pipeline. They're all things I enjoy, which, again, I'm lucky. And, you know, we'll see where that path takes me, man.
Wicked. Well, listen, Joby, all the best of whatever the next move is. Whenever football does return, and in whatever kind of shape it comes back in. Thank you very much for your time, man. I really appreciate you coming on. I really found a lot of that interesting and quite insightful as well. We might have to get you back on another show when it's a bit more lighthearted and fun, one of our usual ones. So if you want to come back on at any point in the next few weeks or months, we'd love to get you back on where we can just... We're doing these things where we look at an iconic game. So we pick out a Premier League iconic game and then we just discuss it for half an hour, 45 minutes, just... have some fun. So we'll try and... We've got some Liverpool games lined up, actually. We've got the 4-1 win at Old Trafford. We've got the 4-3 win. We've got the 4-3 win against Newcastle. Because to be fair, we've done the two defeats to Chelsea. The one in... Was it 0-3, G? Or 0-4?
Yeah.
The one that you lost in Roman bought Chelsea the following day. And then last week, we did the Gerrard slip game last week. So, yeah. So, I think...
Come on, man. People are remembering more for that than everything else he did.
That's his crowning moment.
So there's a few in here that want to see this season null and void as well, isn't it?
100%.
No, I'm not on that. But Jordan's definitely on that.
100%. So yeah, we'll have to get you back on one of those shows, man.
Yeah, anytime, man. Pleasure.
Thanks for your time, man. And G, Josh, big up as usual. Nice one. Prior to the show, we are on iTunes, Spotify, and Audio Boom across all the socials, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Follow us, share, subscribe, not to do. Till next week, stay well. Peace.